Welcome to the Theorist Composer Collaboration, a podcast series highlighting modern composers and their compositions. My name is Aaron DiZarilla. I'm the host of this podcast and also a graduate music theory student at Florida State University. Today we have a special episode, the third TCC Roundtable, with today's discussion being on the topic of women in composition. These roundtables are occasional breaks from the interview format of the typical episodes, showcasing casual conversations with various people in and around the music academic industry on the panel. And speaking of the panel, our first panelist is Kinam Nguyen, who is a composer and pianist from Vietnam. Since the early days of her composition career, she has sought to merge her Vietnamese heritage with Western classical education that she received from a young age. This blending of Eastern and Western cultures is a central theme in many of her works. Kinam, welcome back to the podcast. How are you doing?
Hi, Aaron. Thanks for having me back. I'm doing very well.
Yes, it's been quite a while. This roundtable is episode 27, and you were episode 2. So yeah. Thank you for coming back. Of course, we we sit right next to each other in the graduate assistant office. So it's not as if we haven't seen each other in a while, but great to have you back on.
Yeah, I feel great to be here too.
And of course, we have another panelist on here, another TCC alumni, Mary Denny, who is a composer who explores the relationship between sound, music, and memory. She draws inspiration from a wide range of influences, including everything from pop music on the radio to experimental free improvisation. Active in the new music community, Mary's music has been performed by ensembles such as Splinter Reed's Chartreuse Trio and Loud Bang. She has attended the Cartana Sessions for New Music, Longy's Divergent Studio, and Valencia International Performing Arts Summer Festival as a composition fellow. Originally from the Pacific Northwest, she is a graduate student at the University of Michigan and holds a Bachelor of Music in Composition from University of the Pacific. Mary Denny, welcome back to the Theorist Composer Collaboration. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Yeah, thank you. It's wonderful to be back. I'm really looking forward to today's conversation. So can go ahead and get started.
Yes, of course. Of course. Well, before we get started, you know, since both of you are on roundtables, I like to have, if I'm going to have composers, I like to have people who have been on in a while. And let's just do a little update. How is the University of Michigan treating you? Because when we recorded the episode, which I believe is episode 15, Mary, you were just in your transition period. So how's graduate school in Michigan been?
Yeah, I've had a really great experience so far. It's a really wonderful program. Just awesome faculty, awesome people. I've already met a lot of really great composers and performers. It's definitely have the benefit of a school that's a little bit bigger from where I was before. So I've already been hitting the ground running with a bunch of new projects. Been working on some large ensemble music. I have a recording project coming up and some other just really exciting things. So yeah, really loving being here in Ann Arbor. Go blue, as they say. So yeah, really great to be back and definitely have been having a great time here so far.
Cool. How is it compared to the West Coast of California?
It's definitely a little different, for sure. We haven't hit the cold yet, so I'm definitely bracing myself for when the snow finally comes. We have had a weird warm spell where people were having we had an 80 degree Halloween the other day, which was very strange and super windy. So it sounds like this has kind of not been a super normal fall, but so we'll see what happens when it actually starts snowing. But yes, definitely a big change, a welcome one, but a big change for sure.
Certainly. I'm sure January will bring the cold plenty. And Kiam, so obviously you and I have been in contact and we see each other frequently. But for the audience, what have you been up to since, Oh, it must have been April or something. It's been even
Yes,
longer. Yeah.
it was last April that I had my first podcast with you. And yeah, so now I'm already a third year student, a third year doctoral student, which is, wow, so impressive to me. I'm working on my dissertation right now and also trying to figure out the job market, trying to figure out where I'm gonna be next year.
Oh, some light things. I'm sure you are calm on a daily basis about all of those things.
Yeah, I'm trying.
Sure. And all right, so we did that little catch up with everybody. And so, yes, let's move on to the topic of today, of today's roundtable, which is broadly put, women in composition. Now, before I set off the general prompt and then we start doing this, this is a disclaimer that I sent to my panelists here. I don't think it's very hard for any listeners, whether you're frequent or infrequent. I am not a woman, nor do I identify as one. And I'm also not a composer, a music theorist. So, women in composition, I have no personal experience, which is perfectly fine. So, for today's conversation, although this might be a foreign idea to regular listeners of the show, I'm going to try to not talk as much and sit back a bit because we have two highly accomplished young women in composition right here who have plenty of experience and opinions that I think we all need to hear, including myself. So I come at this with trying to be as humble in the situation where I don't know nearly as much what to say, and that's perfectly fine. But let me intro the topic and then we'll get into it. And Mary Kinam, you can take this conversation whatever direction you wish. So, for the most part, I would say most people who talk in good faith about this topic, it's undisputed that women have been systematically excluded from compositional training and opportunity in the history of composition. And even then, the few who do manage to break through typically experience retroactive prejudice of scholars, historians, other composers, and certainly music theorists. And well, in our day and age now, times have certainly changed, but the field of academic music is still complete. Well, not com yeah, let's just go for it. Is male dominated, doubly so for composition, and I can say personally, quintuply so for music theory. And so that's where we lead off here. And I guess I'm first going to prompt Mary, when the topic of women in composition, inclusion on the lines of gender, when that comes up, what comes to your mind?
Yeah, this is a big topic, and I just want to say, first of all, thank you for giving the space for this conversation to happen, just because there are, I think, because it is still such a male-dominated industry, I think that there are some people that are still a little uncomfortable by the topic, that just because there are now more visible women in composition who are doing really wonderful things and are really doing a lot to advance the position of women in music composition, it still makes people, I think, especially men, a little uncomfortable when you bring up the fact that there have been some systemic barriers to your entry into this field. For one thing, and I think a lot of this just starts all the way back in musical training at the very beginning, just because looking back to when I started my career as a pianist, when I was taking piano lessons at a young age, I was not playing music by women. I was playing music by old dead white men. I was not exposed to new music, let alone new music written by women, until I was in my late teens. And so there are a lot of people that just get used to what a composer looks like. And you have a lot of these things that are a lot of these traits of what a composer looks like tend to be very masculine traits. I think how a lot of the kind of public consensus around people like Beethoven is that he was this like troubled, tortured genius, who was kind of mean, but the music was just so good that everybody just was okay with it. And so I think from a young age, a lot of people are very used to seeing what a composer looks like because of the repertoire that they're playing. And so there needs to be a lot of work done at those early stages to get inclusion in there, because if inclusion is conditional like that, where, oh, if you only get to start playing the music by women composers when you really start having the choice, when you're older, when you know more, it's not really inclusion. So I'll start with that, and we'll just see kind of where it goes from there.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing to hear Mary Bell talking about her young, her music education when she was young, because I kind of have a similar experience, even though I was born and raised in Vietnam, right? So as I mentioned, first conversation before coming to the US, I completed a 9-year program in piano performance at the Ho Chi Minh City Conservatory of Music. So basically, I started when I was 9 and then graduated at 18. And besides the conservatory training, I still had to finish my general education in subjects like math, literature, chemistry, physics, you name it. Just to give you some idea of my musical training before I came to the US. And at that time, I didn't really recognize just how male-dominated the field of composition was. All the composers I studied were men. In our piano curriculum, every semester we performed a set repertoire from the Baroque, classical, romantic eras, and some 20th-century pieces for more advanced students. The canonic composers include people like Bach, Beethoven, Schubert, all dead white male. And interestingly, I never thought to question why during my time in Vietnam. There were just no discussions in the music history classes or music theory, or just there's just no discussion at all about the lack of representation of women composers. And to be so honest, while I always have a deep appreciation for those composers, in hindsight, I realized there was a distinct absence of works by female composers. And it wasn't until I moved to the United States for my bachelor's in piano performance, and then for my graduate studies in composition, that I was introduced to women composers like Hildegard of Bingen, Elisabeth Claude, Jacques de la Guerre, Clara Schumann, maybe Nadia Boulanger and Lydia Boulanger, the two sisters. And not to mention a lot of living women composers. I consider myself fortunate enough because I studied directly with incredible women like Dr. Jennifer Jolly at Texas Tech University. And here at Florida State University, we have Dr. Lilia Ugay, who is a really good, incredible professor. And we have lessons with Ellen Twillett, the first female Pulitzer Prize winner in music composition, as well as master classes with notable composers like Du Yun. So needless to say, these women composers have been inspiring me strongly. And of course, I don't want to imply that Vietnam is simply more sexist than the US. It's too simplistic. But yeah, and of course, it's been over 10 years since I was at the Ho Chi Minh City Conservatory. So I don't really know if things may have changed. But I do think Vietnam has fewer scholarly resources and maybe less societal pressure to encourage people to explore women composers.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Remember, especially too, just because like the cultural perspectives are also like different international perspectives are important in this conversation as well, just because I guess another disclaimer that we could say too is that we are kind of coming at this from a distinctly Western music perspective. But it's also worth remembering too that women composers have always existed. It's not a new thing, especially you just mentioned Hildegard von Bingen, whose music was written almost a millennia ago, and we still have records of her and is kind of considered to be one of the first like visible women composers. And it's, I think that you also bring up a really good point too about mentorship and having women composers in these positions, especially like in university settings, women who are available to teach. And because I also did not have, I'm studying with Kristen Custer this semester, wonderful composer, wonderful, wonderful person. But this is actually my first time studying composition with a woman professor, and I'm a first year master's student. And so that is already like, I'm not trying to discount the male teachers that I've had in the past. I've considered myself very lucky to have very great mentorship from them. And especially the teachers that I had were very cognizant of the kind of specific challenges and the specific kind of climate around women in composition. But it's definitely, I think, one of the most important things too is just visibility. Of seeing other women doing things that you want to do and having those older, like the mentorship is a big deal of, and it really also just, I think, comes down to two, like having more women in these positions, especially too when it comes to like things like master classes, like just needing, like actually taking the step of inviting women into these spaces. When there has been historically a lot of exclusion, that I think that the act of invitation and inclusion can be powerful.
So a consistent thread that I'm starting to feel here is obviously the history of it, and how for a lot of our lives, or for anyone's lives when they're growing up, you take what's given to you almost at face value. Or if something is given to you by a mentor or a teacher, this is quality. And if all of quality is men, then that becomes a frame. So, I think something to speak for all men, haha. Something I think that I discount sometimes, and I'm well, certainly others. What is the, like, once you realize, oh, wow, the women composers have been boxed out from my education, or not nearly as visible in history, especially. What is this, the effect that that has, on, your own work, your psychology when you're going forward? What does that do?
Oh gosh, that's a big question. And I think kind of what happens is there's kind of almost a process of like not necessarily unlearning, maybe just relearning, that it's well, it doesn't feel good to know that you've been systemically excluded. And I think that in a lot of music history curriculums, when we're talking about these kinds of things, like it just goes so deep. It really goes so deep that there's a lot of things like I was actually just having this conversation with some people too, that it's like sometimes when we even talk about these historical women composers, their identity as a woman and what that might have meant is kind of deliberately left out of the conversation, where sometimes when we have conversations about people like Clara Schumann, who was a prolific, extremely talented composer, virtuosic pianist, those are kinds of the things that we talk about. And then in kind of the history curriculum, it's kind of like, oh, she met Robert Schumann, they had seven kids, and she just kind of stopped. And no one ever really talks about kind of the politics of what that might have looked like. The fact that, Clara Schumann was widowed, was a professional musician with seven children after Robert Schumann died. And that is an experience that is very different from what her male counterparts would have experienced. And it's just something that we don't talk about. And so some of those kinds of things about like, oh, being a woman, that those specific life experiences just get left out of the conversation. And it's one of those things where there's almost like a sense that sometimes my life experience as a woman doesn't matter sometimes, just in the way that we talk about about composition, because there are some schools of thought around it that think that it just needs to be so objective that who we are as people should not matter so much as how good the music is. And sometimes it's one of those things that I've kind of had to reckon with in myself, is what part does my identity play in the music that I write? And I've come to the conclusion that those things are not two separate things. They're not mutually exclusive. And so I think a lot of that, these kinds of conversations, are almost discrediting the experiences that we have as women and how they're different from those as men, and the impact that that has on the art that we create.
So I think, looking back at that, I feel like in some informal chat with people, especially during my time in Vietnam, there was conversations about how we don't have good women composers because their music is like pretty simple compared to their peers, especially in the classical romantic era. And I was too young at that point, so I don't know how to like answer or talk about that idea. But later I realized that it's just because women didn't have the same level of musical training that men have during that time, and their music was mostly composed for informal setting, like some chamber in-house entertainment, instead of like a professional display of virtuosity. So that was, I think that was one of the reasons why some people have the impression that women's music is kind of inferior. But at the same time, since times has been changing so much, and more and more women have the same level of musical training as men, I don't feel like it's like a valid argument anymore to not include women composers. I remember when I went to the Allen Music Library at FSU, and there was actually a picture or a poster or something like that, and it called, but there weren't that many female composers. And then around in that big quotation, there are names and names and names and names after names of women composers. I think that's a very powerful poster. It just shows us that it's not that we don't have enough music from women composers, it's just that we didn't look hard enough. And to be fair, I'm not saying complex music is better than simple music or whatever, but if people think virtuosity and complexity is their standard for quote-unquote good music, then there's still plenty of resources by women composers. So I don't think that's an excuse, to exclude women composers just because of the lack of musical training that they got in the past.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point to bring up, just the fact that especially we're in a point now where there is no excuse to exclude women composers. And even looking back, there really wasn't an excuse anyways, because there still were women composers who were prodigies on the same level of people like Mozart. It's just history kind of chose not to remember them in the same way. And we also are in a kind of good point now, too, where we can actually go back and start to correct that narrative and start talking, like changing the way that we talk about these people. And I think that there is value in that as well, that we can focus on the past, present, and future a little bit. At the same time, that we can focus on really finding, there's a lot of musicologists and music historians that are doing really excellent work right now in going back and trying to recover the narratives of these women and getting the music of these women composers performed more regularly, getting additions of the sheet music much more accessible, to performers, and there's a lot of really great work happening on that side of bringing these women back into the limelight. And we don't have to all just have Mozart and Beethoven on our concert programs anymore. And I think there's a lot of value in that, just because I think that there's so much insight that can be provided when we take a look back at just what it meant to be a woman composer in that time, especially in these times too, where, like, I think back to in my music history class, we read this a review that Berlioz wrote for Ethel Smyth, and he basically said, "This music is good because she didn't write like a woman," whatever that means.
Yes.
And it's just one of those things that it's so funny to me, and it's probably too coming from this perspective of of being a person in the modern world, but what does a woman composer even sound like? Especially even back then, and now there's so much diversity in style and genre and philosophy around composition between all of these women composers, that that's also not an excuse anymore that it's like there's a woman sound. What does that even mean? That's not, it's just kind of a ridiculous comment. And I think just reading that made me laugh a little bit. And it's kind of unfortunate that such a flimsy argument like that has been used historically to exclude women from these spaces.
So, that leads really well into a question that I sent to both of you is, so we've talked a lot about general perception and then what generates that perception. Have you, on that question that's right there of, not writing like a woman or whatever, have you ever felt pressured to be in that mindset?
I can speak to this a little bit. I would say, yeah, I have. I think just because a lot of times these traits that we associate with good composers tend to be much more masculine traits, there has been, which is also something I've kind of had to unlearn a little bit. There has been, I would say, kind of not necessarily incentive, but a little bit of a push for me to feel like I in the past to masculinize myself, like not put my first name on a score because the name Mary already feels so feminine. And just thinking about, like, if I write something bright and bubbly and happy and simplistic, which I really love that you brought up the point that it's the brought up the point of that a lot of times we value music that's virtuosic, and how it if it's new, which that's another conversation that we can have, but it's I think also relevant to this conversation. That maybe I need to write more music that's complex to just kind of prove myself. And it's definitely not a healthy mindset, I think, for a lot of women. And I think that if we can just start from a young age of presenting women composers alongside male composers to the point where the term woman composer isn't even necessary anymore, I think that we can kind of reduce that sense, that association with the word co composer as masculine.
Yeah, I think I'm quite lucky in a way that my name sounds so gender neutral compared so gender neutral to English speaking people. Like if you tell my name and don't know who I am, no one can guess my gender. So I don't have that feeling that I'm so afraid of putting my name into my music because I'm afraid it make me sound more feminine. Yeah, so it's just I think it's just a nice thing to share here. But yeah, I think in general, I despite growing up in a quite a different culture, of course, Vietnamese culture could be sexist in some ways. I feel like I grew up in a family where my femininity is very cherished and valued. And also, looking back on my time at the Ho Chi Minh City Conservatory, I studied under remarkable female composers in piano, oral skills, music theory, though they do not specialize in composition. But these women were absolutely foundational to my growth as a musician. So I think they gave me a hope that I could be a musician like them, maybe not necessarily a composer, but any kind of musician, either a performer, music theorist, something like that, because I do have those role model in my life.
So, Keenan, you come at this from a very unique position. As you've said and said in the bio, you take much pride and representation in your music of your Vietnamese heritage, which is one of the many things I love in your music. But in this conversation of representation, exclusion, inclusion, as I appreciate, Mary, you saying earlier that we are coming at this from a uniquely Western perspective for most of it. But Keenum, you particularly have to deal with issues of intersectionality. You're an international student, you're from Vietnam. Historically, the United States has a great relationship with Vietnam. Of course, I'm joking. And of course, you are a woman in composition, in academia. So I suppose I'm asking, what has that experience been of both being not from the Western sphere of influence or Western sphere in the United States, dealing with the societal issues that we have on top of, dealing with racism and exclusion and prejudice in that sense.
So as an international student, I think we have particular challenges compared to my American peers. The US surely gives me many more learning resources and opportunities, but at the same time, the playing field is much larger. Like when you're in a super developed country like the US, somehow you feel like your play fields, like the whole world, is not at a local level anymore. And of course, I don't have the home field advantage that I had in Vietnam, because in music, the network and mentorship culture is essential for us to getting known, finding opportunities, or even just feeling confident in promoting our work. For someone who's new to this environment, it can feel intimidating to break in. And even though music might be relatively universal language in some ways, the cultural nuances around building a career in music here is still something that I'm still learning. And on top of that, there are strict restrictions for international students. For instance, we are limited in terms of employment, whether it's internships, part-time jobs, or even certain gigs and competitions. There are tight regulations around work authorization. So if I want to take on a professional opportunity, I often have to navigate a lot of bureaucracy just to comply with visa regulations. And this can mean passing up valuable experiences that American students can take for granted. And while studying in the US has been a life-changing opportunity for me, there are definitely challenges that go beyond the music itself. And moreover, at every school I've attended in the US, I've rarely come across another Vietnamese student in the music program, let alone in the composition department. And being one of the few Vietnamese students studying music definitely make me feel unique, but it can also be pretty isolating. And many of my friends from Vietnam have also come to study in the US, but they mostly chose fields like business, IT, or STEM, and I completely understand their choice. Because to be super honest here, music, whether in Vietnam or in the US, is still considered quite a narrow and somewhat risky career path. So pursuing music is not an easy decision. So I feel incredibly lucky to have my family's support to follow my passion. And for example, my mother, she's been my role model in many ways. She grew up during a very difficult period. And when the Vietnam War ended, she was just 12 years old, and the country faced years of instability and poverty. And my grandfather didn't have much faith in the new government, so he didn't think education would lead to anything for my mother. He wanted her to stay home, maybe become a seamstress, marry early, and settle into a simple life in the countryside. But even at that young age, my mother had a different vision for herself. And just after finishing high school, I mean middle school, she ran away from home to attend high school in a town far away from her family. And for a young girl at that time, it was a profound act of independence. And though she's not a musician and never had any musical training, she always have a love for music. And with that passion, she bought an old piano for me when I was 4, and she somehow managed to pay for my piano lessons. And to give you some ideas, the US had only lifted its embargo on Vietnam about 2 years before I was born. So the country's economy was still recovering, I guess. And music and the arts were quite a luxury for many families at that time. But my mother had this, like, this belief that music could offer me a better life, a sense of purpose, a future. So I think I carry her spirit with me and her resilience. And that spirit has helped me navigate the challenges I faced as an international student in the US, because somehow her story made me feel that I could defy the odds and follow what I love. And with by doing so, I can go to places that I never expected. So yeah, I still have that hope and the spirit in me.
I mean, yeah, how do you follow that? That is really beautifully put. I think really beautifully put, a really great story. And I think that it's worth, yeah, pointing out that like your experiences at it as an international student are valid. And it is also a problem too that the United States, I think a lot of these policies are definitely informed more by things like xenophobia and fear of outsiders than they are actually like any real like policy reasons. And I think, yeah, knowing a lot of international students that it is an issue that the barrier to entry is kind of so bogged down by bureaucracy. And especially, you know, as a native born citizen, that's a problem I will never have. And I already have like a privilege to have been born in this country where I will never have to navigate those systems that are also a form of exclusion that will, I think, it's hard to because we're here because we love this art form and we love what we do and we have this music inside of us that we just want to share with the world. And it is very disheartening to know that there's so many barriers from all axes, whether it's race, gender, citizenship status, all of those things that are really in place to exclude people. And I think it's hard. It's really hard to navigate. And I really just commend you because that was such a moving statement that you just said. And it's a very important reminder, I think, for a lot of people that the axes of oppression are not just one-sided and that they're oftentimes will pile up on each other and will make these things even more difficult. And so the fact that you're here and doing what you're doing, I really commend you for that. That's incredible.
Thank you, Mary. Yeah, of course, I don't want to come off as complaining person. So I think for now, while waiting for things to get better in the future, at this point, all I can do is to make sure that I find opportunities that where I have equal, I guess, equal opportunity with my American friends. Like, for example, there are competitions that accept composers from any nationality. So those are things that I'm looking for. And yeah, just look for opportunities that have a wider a range for applicants, I guess. And I see. And also, I actually was supported by a lot of people in America, whether they are citizens or not. Like, I know friends and professors who are working in the US. They still don't have their citizenship yet, but they've already established a good career and a life here in the US. And they are the people who really understand the hardship of international students like me. And some of them could help me a lot. And I really want that one day when I could be at their level, I could also help those international students who really love to study here and want to advance their skills and knowledge here with all the opportunities that the US can bring to them.
I want to second what Mary said. Thank you very much for sharing your experience and your story with that. Very important to hear and impactful. So I feel weird to pivot away from that, but I suppose I am. But let's talk about festivals and the compositional circuit, I guess, and the university systems. You know, in talks of systematic and societal change, there's always conversations of top down versus bottom up. Although I'm no historian, I am going to go as far to say that the systematic changes that make today possible certainly were bottom up, and a lot of struggle, and a lot of legwork, and a lot of suffering, and a lot of bravery. But now let's talk about today, less so history, today's environment. And I would say, I really want to hear both of your opinions on this. I would say mostly good faith attempts that are top down to make music and composition more representative and having more women composers, not just being taught, but being platformed, such as both of you. You can take this question however you want, but is that top-down approach in both of your experiences for the most part genuine, and does it work?
Yeah, I guess I can start with this one. I think there I will say the top-down approach does work in some ways, but there are a lot of caveats and some I think it does feel a little conditional just because a lot of this is coming from the administrative level, and there are certain things that I think in recent developments that people have kind of realized, oh, we have not updated with the times. We have not gotten with the times. Our programs look the same as they did 300 years ago. And when we run the data, it's the kind of thing where, like, a lot of large, well-respected arts institutions like the LA Philharmonic, the New York Philharmonic, all of these really big orchestras, when you look at it from the purely like numbers perspective, they're still only playing a very, very small percentage of their pieces, their programming are by women. And so there's kind of a mindset now that just to bring that number up, to get it closer to 50% of the music by women is being programmed to, represent the population of this planet, a lot of this is coming from not necessarily a genuine point of view, but more of a point of view to meet a quota, to bring those numbers up. And I don't necessarily think that to start out with, it's totally a bad thing. I think that if it means that more women are going to be platformed because they're just trying to reach a quota, maybe it's okay. However, that being said, I just don't think it's a sustainable platform for the future. I just think that it kind of discredits the hard work and things that go into composition and the work that and like the work that a lot of these composers have put in. And I think that to get programmed just because you're a woman, so that this large, respectable organization can meet a quota, is feels a little bit disingenuous and a little bit less organic. And I think that it comes from the fact too that these organizations are also very male dominated in their administrations. They are people who, as you've mentioned, do not have experience with this topic. And if there was nobody, if and behind closed doors, if there was nobody telling them otherwise, they would just keep programming all the old stuff. And well, I think it can be maybe a good motivator to start out with. There just needs to be more of a systemic change to move beyond this male versus female ratio. And I know this too, just because there's a lot of universities that are also looking at their programming and realizing, oh, only 20% of the music we're programming is by a woman composer. And of that 20%, only, half of those, less than half of those pieces, if we're being honest, are by women of color. And I think sometimes those efforts can be noble of just like, let's actively look for works so that we can bring that number up. It's just not a sustainable practice in the long run. And I think it just comes to the fact that there needs to be more inclusion at all levels, not just of women composers, because there kind of gets to be this sense that, oh, you have to wait for us to invite you in when it serves the per when it serves our purpose and when it will make us look better. And that is not real progress. That is not real inclusion. And I think there needs to be a mindset change to programming these works because they are good, because they are valuable, and not because it will raise the number of works by women composers that will program, because we have these older white men on our boards who will just play Beethoven and Mahler if there's nobody telling them not to.
Yeah, I totally agree with Mary. Those are all the things that I also encountered too. And I feel like from my personal experience, in supporting women composers, I think it's super essential that we consider the broader network of women musicians in general, not just composers, because throughout my journey, I've been incredibly fortunate to have the support of like many remarkable women in music. Like, for example, my professors, my piano professors, like Dr. Terry Schaffner-Emrick at North Park University and Dr. Tatiana Mann at Texas Tech, both of them have been invaluable mentors who gave me guidance and encouragement at important pivotal moments. And then there's Dr. Sheila Davids, who premiered my last choral work, Buddhist Poems from Vietnam at North Park University. And I would say the premiere of that work is a huge milestone for me because it's quite a long work. It's like 60 minutes something with multiple movement. And also the theme is still like a theme of Vietnamese Buddhism. It's not a very popular theme in choral repertoire, considering that choral music has a very deep root in European liturgical traditions, right? And of course, I'm not certainly the first composer to compose for such kind of theme. Like, for example, Nadia Boulanger's Fien Prayer Bouddhique, the old Buddhist prayers, is an incredible example that I highly recommend. But while still I deeply respect her work, I feel like I have access to something unique in creating Buddhist poems from Vietnam, like the original poems written by ancient monks in Vietnam. Yeah, so I sorry if I'm talking about my piece too much, but my point is that I just feel like it's the women musicians in general who genuinely and actively try to look out for other women and support other women. And I think that the sense of sisterhood, I would say, is really something that I truly deeply appreciate during my career.
So, both of you bring the, I just asked a question a little bit ago about top down versus bottom up, and we're kind of looking at the top down right now, or how does that work or not work? And both of you bring up Some great points. And I love the discussion of women, not just in composition, but in the entire system. Now, Mary, one thing I appreciate that you said at the very beginning was that you brought up the unwillingness or uncomfortableness of people in positions of power and privilege, men, in patriarchal systems to even discuss topics such as this. And so I'm thinking, although there are ways to be better and to do better in patriarchal systems with top-down approaches, fundamentally, it can't remain patriarchal in any sense for that to be true, is essentially what both of you are saying. So, you know, in some ways, for there to be systematic, there needs to be fundamental change, which come see, come saw, those might mean the same thing to some people, but that's essentially what you're saying, right?
Yeah, I think so. And just kind of to talk about your point about like privilege and power, I feel like we kind of can't talk about this without just addressing the elephant in the room of the situation that's been happening with the New York Philharmonic, and just the recent exposure of really the ugly patriarchal male violence that has kind of undercut what is widely considered to be a very respectable institution. And I think it's one of those things to remind ourselves that, as horrible as it is, and that the experiences of these women are very valid, that this is not an isolated incident of just, and maybe if for the people who are not aware of, there was an article published a few months ago that essentially exposed two men in the New York Philharmonic who had been assaulting women and their orchestra, and that there had been a very brutal, violent assault that had happened to one of the only women in the brass section that had been essentially covered up by the orchestra, and these men's positions were reinstated in the orchestra. And just so you know, like the article is worth a read, but massive trigger warning. It does go into some graphic details of the situation. And it's kind of a painful reminder that even though we've made a lot of progress, there's still a lot of ways to go. And that this top-down approach coming from these large, respected, and I say that in air quotes because it's, you know, someone who's been following the situation, especially as a brass player as well, that there has been a lot of talk about this. And I don't mean to sit talk about this to like bring the conversation down, but the top-down approach does not always work because they're when there's not the right people in the organization. Like I think the fact that a lot of these arts organizations have gone to such great lengths to essentially protect and shelter abusers and then shut out the victims and the survivors is not helping. And it doesn't, honestly, kind of doesn't matter if the New York Philharmonic is like, well, we programmed women composers, so we're doing something right, because they're not, obviously. There is a very clear systemic position that essentially values these violent male abusers over the women in their orchestra. And essentially what happened was, is this woman, her she's a horn player named Kara Kaiser, was essentially shut out of the orchestra after she spoke out against the horrific acts of violence that were committed against her. And those kinds of things, I don't think we can have these conversations about what true representation and equality looks like without talking about these things. And that it is about more than just getting women composers on the program.
Yeah, I totally agree that there's a lot of I would say systematic things that prevent you, like make women feel like they're not super welcome in the house of music. Yeah, besides all of the violence and the assault, I feel like there's also some kind of social pressure in women, not only in music, but like women in general, right? Because there are pressure that I don't feel like the a male counterpart have to really go through. Because from my experience, I know really, really talented, incredible women who kind of have to sacrifice their career for their families and loved ones, because it's for some reason it's just feel like it's the women's responsibility to do that more than it's not as expected as like the men. They are not as like super expected to do that as the women. And I would say maybe my mom is one of an example, and a lot of other women that I know, we just don't feel like there's a kind of systematic support that make us feel like we can have both a dream career and still balance that work, like to have a good work-life balance. And essentially some women still feel like they have to sacrifice either one of them, which is I would say, which is a really huge topic.
Yeah, it's definitely very difficult to navigate because a lot of these women that are in these positions, I think when they experience things like prejudice or even like acts of violence and assault against them, they're just kind of expected to not talk about it and move on. And then also too, with there's also the expectation of women to settle down and have families, and that's not something that's necessarily exclusive to musicians. That is just a societal pressure of living in a patriarchal society. That's just kind of something that that's something a lot of women have to navigate. And I definitely see too that I think for women is like music is not necessarily considered like as much of a respectable career, I think, as some other things that I can imagine that for a lot of women who want to have who want to have like careers in music, but also want to have families, there can definitely be that pressure that I have to do one or the other. And I even have had another female musician like say to me, like when I was to, like discussing like, oh, I want to go to grad school and things like that, her one of the pieces of advice that she gave me that I still remember was that she said, well, if you want to do a DMA, like you just need to go through it right now while you're like not married and not settled down, because she was like, don't be like me, because I got married super young and then I had kids, and I was always on my mind to do a DMA. And then I had kids, and I don't actually know if I'll ever go back, if I'll ever have the chance to go back and do the DMA. That it's just very sad and disheartening that there's this kind of expectation that once you have kids as a woman, that that's kind of what you have to focus on.
Yes, like when you have kids, there's gonna be a lot of more responsibility. And yeah, I don't know. For some reason, I don't feel like the guys have the same kind of social pressure to, like pick either family or career. It's mostly the dilemma for the women to deal with.
Certainly. I see that with some of my own colleagues in the music theory department. There are some of my female colleagues who weigh between starting family or getting married and what that does to their career. Whereas with men, it's as much of a desire, but there's not so much of a discussion, or at least not verbally, of what the blowback would be, because there probably wouldn't be nearly as much, or at least societally, with pressure. And let's talk about societal pressure. So, in the sense of moving forward or doing better, I suppose, with all the things that we've talked about, now in today's age, there's a lot of, incentive programs. There's scholarships or festivals, there's for new up and coming female composers, or, programs, whether through tokenism or actually wanting to be inclusive, maybe seek out women composers more. We already discussed that a bit before. But all these different things, and I suppose societal pressure is a big one, in both of your perceptions, you're both graduate students, so you're kind of like, not morally, but you're kind of looking down at the undergraduates, seeing what they're experiencing, seeing, maybe high schoolers, seeing what they're experiencing now that you're past it. Are women adequately encouraged to pursue the arts, to pursue composition, past all of these struggles and especially societal pressure?
I would say at the undergrad level, I feel like most of the undergrad women composers that I know of, they don't feel like they have that pressure yet. I think they're really, really trying to focus on their career as a musician, and this is something I really encourage them to keep doing. Because I was like that when I was undergrad too. I didn't really care about the social pressure. Maybe I just start caring about that now when I'm almost done with my doctoral degree. But as I just feel like as young undergrad student, just explore on possibilities, try to navigate this whole world. Just don't try to be conform to any kind of social pressure, I guess. That's all I really hope for my younger student.
Yeah, really awesome reminders. And I think too, just with it definitely is getting better. And I'm starting to see just kind of with all these classes underneath me, the ratio of men to women is it's getting better. And there's more and more. And I can definitely see that I think that some of those things that we talked about how, oh, we're just not used to seeing women composers in our young early educations. I think those things are starting to get better just because I'm starting to see more women in these programs, and that's a great thing. And I think I just really love what you said about like non-conforming to what everybody else is doing, just because I feel that there's value in these unique perspectives and there's power in that. And there have been some moments too where I've just thought, well, can I just want to focus on the music. Like these conversations just feel so arbitrary. Like it feels so counterintuitive to my artistic process. But at the same time, like, I have a unique perspective. You have a unique perspective. All of these other students who are balancing these different intersections of their identities have unique perspectives that the world needs to hear. And that conforming to a lot of these social pressures is almost denying those unique perspectives. The world needs to hear that. The way that you see it, and that you have experienced certain things, and there's power in it. And I think that it's really important for us, especially now that we're starting to get into those not necessarily positions of power, but just kind of these positions of seniority to really encourage those students to do those things.
Certainly, certainly. And so, again, on the topic of moving forward, encouraging your peers and the people that are coming next from you. I, in a broad sense, in education, I've always thought, in my belief, the point of being a teacher is making sure that when students leave your room or leave, your space, that they are better than you were at their point. And you can apply that to here. And so let's be really general, or I get you can get specific, but this is the really generic question. But it is important. What can actually, other than encouragement and diligence, which are not to be discounted as small things, they can be very difficult. Just as you said, sometimes I just want to focus on the damn music. If you get so caught up with things, but what are some actionable things that can be done to improve? Whether that's, and I'm not saying who has the burden, but if you want to say, in terms of people in power should do that, other than just being considerate and having a more open mind and so on, what are actionable things that can be done to improve the conditions, opportunity, and environment for women pursuing career in the arts and, let's say, composition?
Yeah, so perhaps as teachers, I always think it's important for us to include more repertoire by women composers. Like I remember when I was an instructor in music theory one and or maybe elementary of music, I don't really remember, but yeah, it's a very early level of music theory, and we had to come up with a repertoire for the student to do for their final test, and all of the repertoire I picked was like pieces by let's say Schubert, people like him, and my professor was like, maybe try to include more women composers or composers from a more diversity background, and I was like, oh, I didn't even think of that. So yeah, that's something I feel like even I myself have to work on too, because even though I can consider myself as a quote unquote diversity composer or whatever that is, I still kind of blindly do something just because it's a habit, just because it's something that I did before when I was a student. And if I'm not conscious enough, I could still keep perpetuating the situation. So it's just something that I really need to be aware of.
Yeah, definitely. I think that even though, yeah, we have talked a lot about our experiences as women and experiences women composers, we definitely do have our own blind spots and biases that are worth addressing. And that can be, I think, really said too. And I did mention, say, like, oh, these rooms full of men would just play all the old dead white men if they could. And I also want to add to that that it I don't necessarily think that it comes from a position, at least now, of deliberately keeping women out of the conversation or keeping women out. It's just because it's what they know, it's what they're used to, it's what in their minds they've been taught is good music. And so I think it is more just about kind of challenging those perspectives and allowing the space for them to kind of unpack, for people to kind of unpack these perceptions of what a composer looks like. What does good music sound like? And who are the, when we think of that, who are the people that fit those descriptions and confront our own biases about that? That being said, I think there are a lot of places too that are, opening up things like calls for scores in festivals too, that are also just kind of, like say, like, hey, let's open this up to just women and just women or just women or people of color. And those kinds of things I do think are helpful, just because in so many situations that I don't mean to say that, but maybe it's not a bad thing to just exclude the men for a moment. I think that sometimes if we focus on those people, that we are opening ourselves up to new perspectives that need to be heard. We are giving them an opportunity that to have those things heard, just because, there are things too where they'll see a man's name on the application and might subconsciously favor that one over the women, or see a white American looking name and subconsciously favor that over the other. And so sometimes I think that it can be a little bit forced, but I think it can be a necessary step of just saying, hey, we program enough white men already. What happens if we just look at this other pool of composers that have been historically excluded? And there's a lot of, I think that in the long term, it may not be super sustainable. And I think the ultimate goal that we should be moving towards is just what a good composer is transcends the boundaries of race and gender and nationality and or the complexity of the music that they write. But there is a path forward, and it is a we're taking it is baby steps, but I think that we are moving in that right direction.
I would agree. I would agree, thankfully. And I appreciate both of you took an inward approach to the question in a way. And Mary, on your comment of sometimes, the men can take a rest in a certain thing. That's something that I've had to learn about myself. As anyone who knows me, or even the fact that I have a podcast, I'm a talker. I talk a lot. And it's not out of any malice, but sometimes I need to understand that less is more in conversation. And although it may, it is in no way personally offensive that sometimes if I talk or take up enough oxygen in the room, someone else who, especially women, may feel like they can't because of X, Y, and Z. But I'm not thinking about that at all. It's just expressing myself. But sometimes you need to rein yourself in. So I appreciate all of that. It feels weird to come to the close of this conversation because, of course, this is all of this is a multi-generational struggle, and it's not like we just solved it. But I think, I think there have been some great things here. Absolutely have loved this, but we are coming close to the near the end of our time. And so before we go to final thoughts, let's just, what's going on with you guys? Let's start with Keenan. You're working on your dissertation, so you're doing that. But just what's next for you? What's going on?
So as I mentioned before, I'm still trying to look for places that I'm hiring, trying to so ideally I try to have a teaching position in the college level. Other than that, I think there might be some other paths too. But I think for now I'm trying to focus on a more academic path for now. And I see how things going on.
Wonderful. And Mary, how about yourself? You've certainly got, first semester of grad school, right? Well, you've already said a bunch of stuff going on, but what's next for you?
Yeah, I think I'm hoping one of the big projects that I've been working on is I'm writing a wind ensemble piece. It's kind of crazy. I've played in wind ensembles almost my whole life, but have never actually gotten around to writing for it. And so that's been a big project. The piece is almost finished, so I'm hoping to start sending it out to some people to take a look at. Hoping to enter it in some competitions. But that's kind of been my. It's definitely been a big focus of mine over the past couple of weeks. Definitely just in a kind of mode to try things out, experiment with new sounds and instrumentations. So yeah, really looking forward to the things that will come from it. But yeah, definitely just in that creative process right now.
That's a nice
Wonderful.
coincidence because my dissertation is also for the wind ensemble too. Wind ensemble and choir.
Oh,
So
that's awesome. Are
that
you
was
writing
nice that
it?
you brought it up. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds incredible. I'd love to when
Yeah,
if
I will
there's going to be a
surely
performance of
send
it,
it
and I'd
out
love to hear it.
when it's nearly finished to get advice from wind and brass people.
That sounds awesome. Yeah, really cool project.
Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful. And so now we've come essentially to the end here, but final thoughts on anything that we've talked about today, anything that we did not talk about today, anything else either of you want to add? Let's go Mary first.
Yeah, I mean, we did cover a lot of it, but it's worth pointing out too that this is not the first conversation that will be had about this topic, and it will certainly not be the last. And we definitely do need to keep encouraging people to confront the biases that they have, but to confront the things that make them uncomfortable. And also too, there are opportunities, I think. And some of these gripes that I've had, I've talked about having with very large music, like established musical institutions. And even though there's a lot of work to be done in those spaces, there still are spaces. I think that I really loved what Keenum said about sisterhood. There's a lot of It's really important, I think, for other women in music to lift each other up and to champion each other's works and the things that we're doing. Because there is, I think, strength in numbers and there's power in that. And I think that there are a lot of small, we don't have to change the world. We don't have to change the world tomorrow. There is, as nice as it would be, there's, I think, a lot of times that we can focus on making our own opportunities and focusing on the things that are important to us as a community. And not necessarily waiting for these other larger institutions to catch up. And I think there's a lot of people that, you know, who's to say what the future will hold for some of these large arts institutions that are, you know, I think that are struggling, that I think their lack of inclusion and diversity is, I think could be their downfall. And I think there's a lot of power in finding and coming together as a community and not just waiting for these organizations to catch up.
Yeah, totally agree with Mary. I think the last thing I just want to add is that supporting women doesn't mean doing men any disservice. Fighting against the patriarchy doesn't mean fighting against men themselves. I just feel like once women's situation is better, it's better for everyone in the community. So I don't think we should have some kind of zero-sum game mindset where uplifting one group means harming the other group. I don't think that's the right mindset in music and maybe in many a lot of other things in life.
Yeah, I love the metaphor that it's, I can't remember who said this, but it's not about taking away the chairs at the seats at the table. It's about bringing more chairs to the table.
That's right, that's beautiful.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate both of you very much for coming back onto the Theorist Composer Collaboration for this roundtable on women in composition. It's been great to catch up with both of you on this platform, and I'm sure the listeners will be happy to see familiar faces back. And thank you again for coming onto the roundtable.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for giving us this platform.
Hello, this is Aaron again. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Theorist Composer Collaboration. I also want to give another big thank you to Keenan Nguyen and Mary Denny for coming on to the podcast to discuss the topic of women in composition. Both of their contact infos are listed in the description, and I would appreciate it if you could show them some support. For further updates and notifications on the Theorist Composer Collaboration, make sure to follow our Instagram and Facebook pages. You can listen to future episodes through our host website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to the platform of your choosing. If you want to monetarily support the work of the TCC, you can click the link to our Buy Me a Coffee page. All donations are highly appreciated. All of the relevant links to follow, listen to, and support the show are in the description. TCC episodes are posted every other week on Mondays, and don't miss our blog posts, which go live a few days after a new episode is added. Make sure to again follow all of our social media accounts and relevant streaming platforms because you won't want to miss any of this content. But until then, this is Aaron, and thank you for joining the TCC.